From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are just hours away from the meeting in Singapore between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But the hangover from the last summit Trump attended continues after harsh words from Trump administration officials for one of America's closest allies, Canada. Joining us now is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the president is set to meet Kim Jong-un at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. He is going to be giving a press conference at 4 a.m. Eastern time tomorrow, just in time for the morning shows. Is it fair to say that this is calculated for a U.S. audience?
Well, absolutely. And the fact that Donald Trump and Kim are going to meet without any advisors or specialists, they're just going to have translators. That shows you not only that the president really believes he can make a personal rapport with Kim, but also this is about theater, and it's not really about the nitty-gritty details of denuclearization. And, you know, the president has been saying this is really a get-to-know-you session. There probably will have to be many more meetings.
What's at stake for the president politically with this summit?
So much is at stake. First of all, he has been, even though he's been downplaying expectations for this summit, in one way he's been raising them. And he raised them by getting out of the Iran deal. That means that he has to strike a better deal with North Korea than the one that he said was absolutely horrible that he got out of with Iran. What does that mean? The Iran deal got 97% of Iran's nuclear fuel out of the country. If the president can't do better than that with North Korea, he's failed his own test. He also has a problem because this is the only diplomatic effort he's got going. He had two summits with China. Nothing came of them yet. He otherwise has been pulling out of international agreements and sanctioning countries. He hasn't actually made any kind of a diplomatic effort that's turned out to be successful. And of course, he left the G7
right
in a real huff.
Well, let's talk about that and the harsh words from the Trump administration about Canada. Here's the director of trade policy, Peter Navarro, speaking on Fox News Sunday.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door.
He's talking there about the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and this is Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, who had similar words on CNN.
He really kind of stabbed us in the back. He really actually, you know what, he did a great disservice to the whole G7.
Now, Mara, Trudeau didn't actually say anything in that press conference that he hadn't said publicly before, basically that Canada was insulted by U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum that were based on national security concerns. Why is the White House getting so angry with him?
Well, the president got angry with him, and then his advisors have to try to rationalize why he was. But Larry Kudlow is a very honest guy, and he's usually pretty open. And he went on to say that the president of the United States is not going to let a Canadian prime minister push him around on the eve of the North Korea summit. He is not going to permit any show of weakness on the trip to negotiate with North Korea. Kim must not see American weakness. So for Donald Trump, which strength is his brand, he didn't like it that another foreign leader would stand up and say, I'm going to stand up for my own country's interests. Canada is going to put tariffs on the United States in response to the tariffs that Donald Trump put on Canada. And the president didn't like it.
And Senator John McCain didn't like what the president did. He wrote over the weekend that Americans stand with U.S. allies, even if our president doesn't, something we're not hearing from other Republicans so far.
Well, in general, Republicans bite their tongues when it comes to things that Donald Trump does or says that they disagree with. However, the tariffs and trade is the one issue where Republicans have pushed back against Trump. There's actually legislation in the works to give Congress a kind of veto over Donald Trump putting tariffs on other countries and using national security as a reason. I don't know if it will go anywhere. Republicans are very, very loath to cross the president between now and the November elections, but there are little rumblings of pushback.
It's NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as the clock ticks down to that historic meeting in Singapore, let's bring in someone who's been face-to-face with North Korea, if not Kim Jong-un. Joel Witt is a former State Department official who oversaw one of the last agreements the U.S. had with North Korea in the 1990s. It also was to denuclearize the country, but it was to get the North to stop producing nuclear bomb material. The country didn't have the weapons yet. A few years later, there was also a moratorium on testing long-range missiles. Both deals fell apart. Joel Witt is now with the Stimson Center and founder of the website 38 North, which tracks North Korea. Joel, we've been hearing there will be a deal agreed to at this summit between Trump and Kim and later with their aides. What do you think has to happen at this meeting?
Well, I think what has to happen is President Trump needs to walk away from the meeting with some sort of document, a statement issued by himself and Kim Jong-un, and that document has to include the words denuclearization. I don't think they can walk away without a document, and they can't walk away saying that they got to know each other and they're going to meet again. They have to have some substance.
Well, and give us a sense of what might be happening there. I'm looking at William Perry, a former Secretary of Defense, who went to Pyongyang three times. He was involved in talks in the late 90s and early 2000s, and he said there's a weirdness. When he was going to his meeting, the government there had hundreds of forced laborers shovel snow on 60 miles of highway to get him to the meeting. And everyone considered the Kim family to be gods. So when you're sitting in a room with aides who think their leader is a god, how does that affect the meeting?
It doesn't affect the meeting at all because we're not there to talk about their political system. We're not there to talk about their leader. We're there to focus on substance. And if you do that, then you can negotiate with them. And so I understand, yes, we're supposed to avoid that topic. But if you know that ahead of time, then talking to them isn't that difficult.
Well, President Trump has said that attitude is the most important ingredient, and he's prepared for this his whole life. He'll know in 1 minute whether things are going well. You've negotiated with the North Koreans. How does that strike you?
Well, that strikes me as public posturing. I mean, how many presidents have gone into meetings with dictators and come out and said they read them within a minute? I mean, a lot have. George Bush said he read Putin in a minute. And so, you know, I think that's public posturing. And the point is, when you sit down, you're not going to know within a minute whether you have some sort of connection to the other guy. But I think what President Trump will know ahead of time is what is the shape of the deal, because it will have been worked out ahead of time.
Yeah. And we've been hearing this from our reporter, Anthony Kuhn, in Singapore, that they will probably come out with a deal that says denuclearization, that requires that North Korea do that. And on the other side, there will be security promises. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today the U.S. is prepared to provide security assurances that are different and unique. The North wants U.S. troops out. They want sanctions dropped. What do you think is going to be on that side of the equation?
This is North Korea 101. Those of us who have talked to the North Koreans understand what they want. They say they want U.S. hostile policy lifted. That means recognizing them as a country. It means diplomatic relations. It means dealing with their security concerns, and that means ending the Korean War with a peace treaty. And it means lifting the economic sanctions and other restrictions on them. So all of those things are in what the North Koreans want from us. And I think a summit document will have to talk about how the U.S. has agreed to end its hostile policy and move forward on those different fronts.
Do you think, Joel Witt, that things have changed in North Korea? As you said, you know, we're not there to change their political system, and you've been quoted as saying there are certain subjects you stay away from because you're not going to affect them at all. But do you think there's a possibility that several generations down from Kim Il-sung, the current Kim's late grandfather, that there's a possibility that things have changed on that level?
Well, you know, this is one of the misconceptions about North Korea, that it's this hermit kingdom that's been static for the past 30, 40 years. And the fact is, if Kim Il-sung was alive today and looked around North Korea, he wouldn't recognize a lot of it, particularly the economy, which has change from a tightly directed socialist economy to one that is now a mix of socialism and capitalism. The social system has not changed as much, and the political system, of course, is still tightly controlled.
And do you trust any promises, any agreements the North Koreans make this time around?
Well, you know, I wouldn't trust what they say, and I don't think anyone would trust what they say or trust anyone who's been an adversary for as long as they have. And I don't think there's been one U.S. government has been that naive in dealing with the North Koreans. So, of course, this gets to the issue of verifying whatever is agreed to. And that goes without saying. We are going to have to verify all the agreements we reach with them.
That's Joel Witt, founder of 38 North website. They track North Korea. He also was involved in past talks and negotiations. Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Twenty-five years ago today, the world was introduced to this.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Steven Spielberg's film Jurassic Park captured the attention of millions when it was released in 1993. It earned three Academy Awards and pulled in almost $915 million worldwide, making it the highest-grossing film ever at the time. In case you've been living in amber for the last 25 years, the film followed paleontologist Dr. Alan Grant and paleobotanist Dr. Ellie Sattler, who were brought to a theme park where the theme is living dinosaurs resurrected by 65-million-year-old DNA, cloned and edited by a team of scientists. Everything is great at Jurassic Park until it isn't. The movie helped redefine popular conceptions of dinosaurs, and that's thanks in part to our next guest, paleontologist Jack Horner. He served as an advisor to the film series and also partly inspired the Dr. Grant character. He joins us from Bozeman, Montana. Jack Horner, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you believe it's been 25 years?
No, I can't.
Well, and, you know, you helped bring these dinosaurs to the big screen. And before this movie came out, the first one, a lot of people thought of dinosaurs as these slow-moving, cold-blooded, crocodile-like beasts. What was your role in shaping the dinosaurs we saw in the movie?
Well, you know, the times were changing. The movie came out in 93, and the change, you know, sort of the new look and the new ideas about dinosaurs had started back in the late 60s and really sort of got going in the late 70s, and by the 1980s, we did have a pretty good idea that dinosaurs were, you know, pretty special animals, and we knew then that birds were their descendants. Mm-hmm. So the movie, then, you know, we were able to flesh them out a little better, but there, of course, there were some constraints with, you know, technologies that didn't allow us to actually make them exactly the way we wanted to.
And that's changed over the years, obviously. When you right. watch Jurassic World, the dinosaurs, I mean, I will say, even watching Jurassic Park in 1993, the dinosaurs looked pretty realistic. But now you compare the two and it's very different.
They were very realistic. And in fact, you know, we did a pretty good job of making the dinosaurs back in 93 look like we thought they should look according to what we had known at 1993. Now we know, you know, that actually they're quite different. They would have, you know, we know now that most of the meat-eating dinosaurs were feathered and they were probably much more colorful than we see them in the movies. But unfortunately, the storyline has to continue. And so we can't really change the movie stars. We can't change the dinosaurs, really, because
you already made
the
them
dinosaurs.
One way.
That's right. We already made them. So,
well, so. And so you're not going to have feathered dinosaurs in the upcoming Jurassic Park movie.
Well,
you're not allowed to
see that one.
Okay. Well, was there anything else that you've learned about dinosaurs since 1993 that you would have, had you had the opportunity to do it again in 93, that you would have changed with the dinosaurs?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, Steven and I had quite a few arguments about what the dinosaurs should look like.
Steven Spielberg,
and even
I
then
assume
we
you're
knew
talking
that
about.
Steven Spielberg, yes. you know, my job was to make sure the dinosaurs looked as accurate as they could based on the science that we had. And we already knew that Velociraptor and some of those kinds of little theropod dinosaurs were feathered. And we also knew that they could have been very colorful. And Stephen really, he didn't think technicolor dinosaurs would be very scary. But there was also just, you know, technological constraints, trying to render feathers at that point in time when computer graphics were just coming to be.
So, well, and feathers, I guess, also are not as scary as scales.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah, technicolor feathered dinosaurs, they would not be as scary as what we ended up with.
Well, the other thing is that velociraptors, which are big in the original Jurassic Park, they're taller than humans. In reality, they're more like a foot and a half.
Yeah, well, there are dinosaurs very closely related to Velociraptor, that such as Deinonychus, that comes from Montana, that is a much larger animal. And then there's Utah Raptor that is actually bigger than the Velociraptors in the movie. So, you know, these raptor-like dinosaurs basically come in all sizes.
Mm-hmm. What about the T-Rex? There's a question about whether it was actually a hunter or a scavenger. Did you have that debate with the creators of the film?
Well, I did. I've been one of the people that has pushed the whole scavenger business. And, of course, you know, it wouldn't have played such a big role in the Jurassic Park movies as a scavenger. It is shown kind of as a scavenger in Jurassic Park 3. But I would, you know, even now I would argue that that T-Rex was at least an opportunist, and it wasn't a top predator.
Mm-hmm. Did you think when you were approached to be an advisor to the film that it would become the icon that it is now?
No. And in fact, Stephen and I had a long discussion about, you know, whether the movie was even going to be popular. It seemed like it would. I mean, the dinosaurs were really cool and the sets were great. But, you know, Stephen asked me twice. I remember twice on set him asking whether I thought that kids were going to like it and whether adults were going to like it. And, you know, as my answer always was, kids are always going to like it because kids love dinosaurs.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know how you get adults to like dinosaurs. And yet, you know, the movie did. It did it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about DNA, which is, you know, a big part of the story. They're able to use dinosaur DNA to recreate these dinosaurs in modern times. Do you think that it would be actually possible to do that someday?
Not likely. One of my former doctoral students, Mary Schweitzer, she and I actually had a grant from the National Science Foundation to attempt to extract DNA from a dinosaur. And that was after we knew that that it wasn't going to come out of amber. And quite frankly, over the years, there's been several attempts to extract DNA, and it's never been found. There's a good chance that it will be found, but that the pieces are going to be so tiny that we probably won't be able to do very much with it. So my answer to that is birds or dinosaurs, maybe we can retro-engineer one.
And that brings us to the Chickenosaurus, right, which you've worked with a group to put together. Tell us about that.
Well, we don't seem to be able to find DNA, at least preserved. And if we want to make a dinosaur-like animal, probably the only way to do it is to attempt to find what we call atavistic genes, genes that are sort of ancestral genes that are quiet or turned off during evolution, turn them back on and see if we can't resurrect some of the dinosaur characteristics that birds have lost.
Hmm. What about a woolly mammoth, something that's more well-preserved?
Well, they have found woolly mammoth DNA. I don't know how much. I doubt very much if they have found a lot. I'm guessing that when they attempt to make a woolly mammoth, that they're going to have to use quite a bit of DNA from modern elephants. But they'll get some kind of an elephant that is different than a modern-day elephant, probably a little bit hairier.
But they'll have to find an island that is farther away from, you know, people, just in case.
Oh, you know, that's the, you know, the thing about movies, right? You can give your animals, you know, whatever demeanor you want them. So
right.
In Jurassic Park movies, all the animals want to eat people. But as we all know, we can go out on the Serengeti plain, and as long as you keep your windows rolled up, nobody's going to eat you.
Right. Unless the electric fence goes down, and then you're in trouble.
Well, I don't think
they have those there.
I don't think that's going to be a problem
right. either. If you could build a Jurassic Park, would you?
Absolutely.
So you don't think there's any sort of moral problem with that idea? I mean, the movie definitely brings up some issues with it.
Well, we make chihuahuas out of wolves, so I don't right. see that, you know, making a dinosaur out of a dino chicken is going to be, you know, mm-hmm. any less of a moral dilemma.
So I'm getting from you that dinosaurs may have been nicer than we see them in the movie. Is there a dinosaur that still scares you today?
I would rather be in a room with four lions and a tiger than one velociraptor. Simply because I'm pretty sure that the lions and the tiger will kill me before they eat me, whereas a velociraptor I think is just going to jump on and start eating.
Mm. When you look back at all of the Jurassic Park movies that you've been involved in, which one is your favorite?
Well, the first one's always, you know, yeah. first one's great.
That's Jack Horner, who is a paleontologist and advised the Jurassic Park series of movies. Jack Horner, thank you for helping bring us Jurassic Park, and thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And the new one comes out later this summer. So what are your memories of Jurassic Park 25 years ago? I remember walking to the movie theater to see it with my dad. Let us know at hereandnow.org.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
President Trump railed against trade imbalances several times last night on Twitter, saying other countries make massive trade surpluses while American workers pay such a big and unfair price. He's been focusing on trade imbalances a lot since taking office.
It is the largest deficit of any country in the history of our world. It's out of control.
When you add them all together, we actually have a $17 billion deficit with Canada. We lost over the last number of years $800 billion a year. Not a half a million dollars, not 12 cents. We lost $800 billion a year on trade. Not going to happen. We got to get it back.
Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger for a little explainer. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's start with, what is a trade deficit?
So this is just a measure of imports versus exports. So let's look at 2017. The U.S. imported $2.9 trillion worth of goods and services. It exported $2.3 trillion or so. It amounted to a trade deficit of $566 billion in goods and services.
Goods and services. So you're talking also about things like maybe legal services. That would be counted in that number.
Yes, absolutely.
So is it necessarily a bad thing to have a trade deficit?
You know, I know that there's a lot of confusion around this. Wilbur Ross, who's the Commerce Secretary, said that trade deficits, weaken our economy. Those are the exact words he used. And now economists that I speak to, they say, look, that's just not the case. Imports really don't have an effect on GDP, either positive or negative. And they push back on the Trump administration's emphasis that trade deficits mean that, you know, the U.S. loses and surpluses mean that the U.S. wins. And they say that President Trump too often focuses on the trade in the deficit in goods and disregards the services. And I think that's how he comes up with those numbers that don't quite jibe with the overall.
Who do we have the biggest trade deficit with around the world?
Well, China's on the top of the list. In 2017, the value of Chinese goods imported into the U.S. exceeded the American goods that we exported by about $375 billion. Now, meanwhile, the same period, the U.S. actually ran a $38.5 billion surplus on services trade with China. So overall, goods and services deficit was $336 billion. So that's number one. Next largest is all of the European Union. We can break it down country by country, but let's throw it into one basket, the European Union, $101 billion, and then Mexico at $69
billion. And where do we have the biggest trade surplus?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of trading partners, and we actually have a surplus with six of our 15 largest trading partners as of 2017. Largest trade surplus is with Hong Kong, which is actually isolated as one. Then Brazil, $35 billion, Brazil, $28 billion, Singapore, and the U.K. Now, by the way, despite the president's insistence that the U.S. runs a deficit with Canada, that was actually not the case last year. The U.S. actually ran a surplus with our neighbor to the north.
So is it, I mean, just in the few seconds we have, as scary as it sounds when he says we've got a huge trade deficit all over the place?
No, it is not. And just to be 100% clear, mm-hmm. when we think about this, know that a lot of economists believe that trade enhances U.S. productivity right. and makes the economy stronger.
It's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
The Supreme Court decided a big voting rights case today out of Ohio, and in its 5-4 ruling, the court upheld Ohio's voter purge law. Now, this law allows the state to remove people from the voter rolls if they haven't voted in two straight elections and then also fail to return a mailer to confirm their address. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, this is being seen as a big win for Republicans. Remind us why that is.
Well, there was a Republican government, certainly, in Ohio. The name of the case bears the name of the Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted. The vote being secure is the Republicans' focus here throughout the country when it comes to, you know, trying to eliminate what they see as potential voter fraud. Of course, a lot of studies have not found broad evidence for voter fraud. But you saw Samuel Alito, who wrote the opinion here, actually cited a Pew study at the very beginning talking about how there were some 2.5 million or more people who were registered in two different states. So cleaning up voter rolls, he said, was important.
And because they move, for instance, and so they forget to unregister in one and they're in another. And if they're not voting, that's a way to find them. But federal law doesn't allow voters to be purged from voting lists just for not voting. So
right.
How did the court decide that this Ohio law doesn't violate that federal law?
Well, this was not just about voting. It's about notification. You know, mm-hmm. Justice Alito talked about that Congress had made a reasonable judgment that a person, you know, who's interested in voting wouldn't ignore something like a card that goes to the House that says that if you don't verify your address, you know, you could be purged from the rolls because you haven't voted in two consecutive federal elections. You know, for the dissenters here, that was, they felt, a misinterpretation of the federal law. But the five Republican-appointed justices disagreed.
Yeah, and it was Justice Stephen Breyer who wrote the 18-page dissent. Look, this case came about after the Republican Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, who you mentioned, was sued by civil rights groups representing people who say they were purged. Give us some examples of them.
Well, the person who sued in this case essentially felt wronged by the fact that he had been purged from the rolls inappropriately, he felt, because he lived there and he just ignored the card that went home because, you know, we all get a lot of right. junk mail in the mail and sometimes people don't sift through all of it. In fact, only about 20% of these cards got returned to the Secretary of State's office. So that was an argument that the minority tried to make and that the person who sued in this case tried to make that case as well. So, you know, that was a big part of what a lot of people were – thinking could be the thing that tipped the balance here. But they were some very fierce oral arguments when this case was first going through, and no one was quite sure where it was going to go. You know, we should note that it's a big about face for the Justice Department, because the state of Ohio was essentially ready to settle with this man, and that was during the Obama administration. And then, you know, President Trump won. And the Justice Department changed positions, decided to file a brief on behalf of the state, and Ohio decided to withdraw its potential settlement and went through with this and now won.
Well, look, a handful of states have similar ways of purging voter rolls, but Ohio's is considered the most aggressive going after it. But do you think with this decision we're going to see more states do this?
Most likely, you're going to start to see a lot of secretaries of state who are Republican and governors in those states try to make a push to try to, you know, get to a place where they have more aggressive voter purge laws. Not sure of what is in the works with a lot of places, but this is going to signal for them that to start the ball, get that ball rolling downhill, to start on getting something through legislatures to try to clean up these voter rolls. And look, we should say this Pew study that Justice Alito mentioned, it did note that the voting systems need to be upgraded, that there are a lot of people on these rolls that probably don't belong there. But what civil rights activists will say is, or advocates will say, is that, you know, at what cost? You know, mm-hmm. how many millions of people might be disenfranchised by, you know, misinterpretation of trying to, you know, purge somebody from the voter rolls?
Well, at the very least, pay a lot more attention to the all that mail that comes because
right.
it may be something important about. I mean, one of the, I guess, the gentleman who sued, he hadn't voted 2 years in a row, went to vote, and they said, no, you can't. And so be thinking about that. If you haven't voted 2 years in a row.
Now, it's not 2 years, okay? It's two
elections.
Federal election cycles.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's yeah. right, yeah. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, last night, the 2018 Tony Awards were handed out at Radio City Music Hall, and after a record-breaking season in terms of attendance and box office, two epic plays, but two small musicals came up big. Jeff London reports.
The Best Musical category was filled with large commercial franchises. Tina Fey's adaptation of her popular film Mean Girls and live-action versions of Frozen and SpongeBob SquarePants. But it turned out that an intimate chamber musical based on an independent film was the biggest winner of the night. The band's visit took 10 of the 11 awards for which it was nominated, including Best Musical. It tells the story of an Egyptian police band stranded in a tiny Israeli town, but instead of bringing up the conflicts in the Middle East, it focuses on what the characters from the two different cultures have in common.
Sunday morning, her voice would fill our
Katrina Lenk and Tony Shalhoub won Best Actor in a Musical honors for their roles in the show, and Ariel Stachel, who won Best Supporting Actor, gave an impassioned speech acknowledging both his Yemeni-Israeli heritage and his parents in the audience.
I have avoided so many events with them because for so many years of my life I pretended that I was not a Middle Eastern person. And after 9/11, it was very, very difficult for me. And so I concealed, and I missed so many special events with them. And they're looking at me right now, and I can't believe it.
Stachel says he's proud of the musical's themes.
For telling a small story about Arabs and Israelis getting along at a time where we need that more than ever.
Another story that resonated with Tony voters was the small-scale revival of Once on This Island. It shows a community in the Caribbean dealing with the aftermath of a hurricane by telling a fable.
Little girl, don't you be afraid.
It captured the Tony for Best Musical Revival over the more heavily favored and much more lavish productions of Carousel and My Fair Lady. But it wasn't just small shows which won awards. One of the most recognizable brands came up a big winner. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, an epic two-part, five-and-a-half-hour sequel to J.K. Rowling's books, took 6 Tonys, including Best Play. Best Revival of a Play went to the 7.5-hour Angels in America, written by Tony Kushner. The revival also led to top honors for Andrew Garfield and Nathan Lane.
I want to thank Tony Kushner for being such an adorable genius. Even his emails are Pulitzer-worthy. I'm standing here because Tony wrote one of the greatest plays of the 20th century, and it is still speaking to us as powerfully as ever in the midst of such political insanity.
The current political moment was personified by Robert De Niro, whose profanity-laced comments about the president were bleeped out of the broadcast. But the highlight of the 2018 Tony Awards ceremony, for many people, was an appearance by a teacher and students from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Melody Hertzfeld, the drama teacher who helped save 65 students during the school shooting, won the Tony for Excellence in Theater Education Award. Members of her drama club took the stage to sing Seasons of Love from Rent.
525,600 minutes, 525,000 moments so dear.
For Here and Now, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Republicans in the House are facing a deadline tomorrow over immigration. A number of moderate Republicans say if leadership can't present a bill on DACA by then, they'll force a vote on the issue. Dee Margo is the Republican mayor of El Paso, Texas, on the U.S. border with Mexico. Mayor Margo, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, what do you want to see out of Congress on immigration?
Well, first of all, you've got to deal with the DACA situation. That is critical. I think the problem is that most of them do not understand the border. You know, we're the largest U.S. city on the Mexican border.
Mm-hmm.
We're a regional population of 2.7 million. We like to say we're 3 states, Chihuahua, New Mexico, and Texas, 2 countries, Mexico and the United States, and 1 region of 2.7 million people. You cannot tell the difference between El Paso and Juarez as you fly over.
Mm-hmm.
We're contiguous. We're there. If you can see the river, you can see a difference, but otherwise you can't.
So what do you want them to understand that they don't?
Well, we've been going back and forth. We've got over 400 years of history and culture where families live on both sides of the border. The original home for El Paso was on the south side of the border, of south side of the river. People don't understand that. Even in Texas, there's still a misunderstanding.
Mm.
Well, commerce is critical. NAFTA is especially critical to us.
Do you think it's going to go away?
I hope not. I'm optimistic that they'll resolve. There may be some tweaking that has to be done regarding settlement issues and things like that. But we have 50,000 jobs in El Paso tied to the Maquila manufacturing operation in Juarez. And then we have 70 of the Fortune 100 companies manufacturing in Juarez, Mexico.
And do you think that the U.S. is getting a good deal out of NAFTA? Because President Trump has been saying that it's not.
Oh, I think it's been a good deal all the way around for Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Texas has a positive trade surplus with Mexico. It's over $97 billion. So from our standpoint, it's been significant.
I want to ask you about another issue involving immigration that's gotten a lot of attention. The Trump administration announced in May that it would prosecute anyone crossing the border illegally, and any accompanying children would be taken from their parents and put in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services. Here's the Attorney General Jeff Sessions defending the policy last week in an interview with the conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt.
If people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them. You will be prosecuted if you bring, if you come illegally, and if you bring children, you'll still be prosecuted.
Mayor Margo, have you seen any impact so far of this policy?
Not personally, not up front and close. I mean, we need to deal with immigration once and for all. We wouldn't have all these symptomatic problems as we're not dealing with root cause. We've got to deal with that.
And the root cause is what?
We don't have a rational program for immigration. We're trying to limit those coming in. We need more. We need to do something about the 12 million that are here, especially on the DACA side. That's ridiculous not to be able to take care of that. Those are usually productive citizens. In Texas, we provide in-state tuition for Mexican nationals. It's not a gift. It's not a scholarship. They pay tuition, but we allow it to be in-state.
Is it possible that some of these children who are being separated from their families are going to be housed in El Paso?
They've talked about that. They've talked about the detention centers there, I read last week. I haven't been formally contacted by Homeland Security.
If they did contact you, what would you say? How do you feel about that?
As long as they're properly maintained and there's nothing I can do about the fact that they're here. And I do have a great deal of mixed feelings related to the separation of the families, but I also understand what they're trying to do and send a message. But we've been so haphazard over the years, and not just this president, but even under the preceding president. The perception was we're open doors. And we do need to, while El Paso is the safest city in the United States, we don't have issues on immigration per se or violence of any type. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to protect our borders.
What's the wall like in El Paso?
We don't really have a wall.
At all?
We have a fence that was put up during the Bush administration. And its primary design was to stop criminal activity. It didn't have anything to do with immigration. It had to do with criminal activity of theft and car theft and things like that. And it's been beneficial to stop that. And it seems to work. I really dislike the phraseology, the wall. It reminds me of Berlin. I don't think that's conducive to our relationship with Mexico. But, yes, we do need to protect our borders.
I want to ask you one more thing. You're a Republican, and I noticed in an article recently that you haven't endorsed in the Senate race in Texas between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke.
Oh, I've been staying out of that, but I've supported Beto in the past. So, I mean,
Democrat.
He's a Democrat. He grew up a block away from my family. My kids carpooled with him. I've known Beto and his family for years. They're great people. But I chose not to publicly get involved in any of the races, whether they be congressional or Senate.
You think a Democrat could win statewide in Texas right now?
I don't know. I think it's going to be tough still. But Beto, I think, is a formidable candidate.
That's El Paso Mayor Dee Margo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
And by the way, Mayor Margo says his city pays Customs and Border Patrol $2 million a year to open extra lanes for cars coming into El Paso from Mexico. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.